I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about how not-for-profits and other community organizations choose the issues for which they want to advocate. We're going to talk about the guidelines within which they have to operate and how they make the case once they've decided. My guests will be David Sklar of the Indianapolis Jewish Community Relations Council, Mark Lawrence of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, and Andrew Cullen of the United Way of Central Indiana. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, Facebook is No Limits WFYI, Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu. And by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the ways that not-for-profits and other organizations with a community focus choose the public policy issues that they're going to focus on. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so. Please give us a call at 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Twitter is WFYI, and Facebook is nolimits@wfyi. Well, my guests are three guys who live within that world. David Sklar, who is with the Indianapolis Jewish Community Relations Council. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you here. Mark Lawrence, who's with the Indiana Chamber of Commerce. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
It's good to have you here. And Andrew Cullen, who is with the United Way of Central Indiana. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here on behalf of United Way.
Good. Well, I'd like to start just by saying, let's first talk about what, say, your priorities were for this legislative session, the one that's wrapping up. And we'll work backward from that point about how you decided those were going to be the priorities, and you can walk me through the process. David, how about if you get us started?
Sure. So the JCRC usually works on what a lot of people would sort of term as classically social justice type issues. So we're always following issues of education, human services, and things like that. This year we worked fairly heavily on a bill that would have sought to require drug testing for welfare recipients. We've also been following along with the discussions on early childhood education, mass transit, some recent firearms legislation, and a couple other issues.
And what positions did you stake on the
On the drug testing bill, we are opposed to that bill, supportive of the mass transit bill, supportive of a pilot program for pre-K, opposed to the existing firearms bill.
Okay, and there are a couple of firearms bills.
The particular provision that we're worried about would allow guns on school property.
Okay. Mark, please tell us what the chamber's priorities were.
Well, we had a number of them. We have an overarching document called Indiana Vision 2025, which is our long-range economic development plan that we feel would be good for Indiana. And so our positions are based on that. Of the priority issues, certainly the one that's gotten the most notoriety is the business personal property tax issue, which came up. And that was one that we feel that Indiana is an outlier on this issue. We're one of six or seven states that still have this, and some of our neighboring states we're not in a competitive position on that. And we felt that anything that taxes investment in productivity and ultimately job creation here in the state is not a good thing. And it's caused quite a discussion with many of the local governments, the mayors and others that are being very vocal on not wanting to have another impact on their revenue streams like the property tax caps had on that. We also had a number of education issues that we supported in terms of things such as the early childhood education. We supported that, and a lot of the things that we felt were important. We've been a pretty vocal opponent of the Common Core issue, what's going on there. We feel that there's a lot of disadvantages with the state straying from the Common Core objectives. And then we have a lot of things related to economic development and infrastructure issues as well.
Andrew, how about United Way? In some ways, I understand the constituencies with these other groups, but you have a much broader umbrella to some degree. Does that? So tell me first what the priorities are, and then I'm going to stay with you and ask you how you represent that broader range of constituencies.
Right. Well, that's exactly right. We do have a very wide-ranging constituency. And so as a result, we try to focus our work into four priority areas, and those are education, income, health, and basic needs. So within each of those four areas, we do have areas of public policy that we're focused in, particularly with education. Our primary focus has been early childhood education, and we have been working closely with the General Assembly on the child care regulation bill, which has received a lot of press as of late. That's been our number one priority this legislative session. And we were excited that almost, well, about 2 hours ago, the Senate passed its final version of that bill by a vote of 40-6. So considering that has been, some say, as many as 22 years in the making, that we consider that a pretty exciting opportunity to improve the quality of early childhood education through our daycare centers. We also have been actively engaged in the initiative supported by Speaker Bosma and Governor Pence to create a pre-K voucher program, because while the CCDF dollars that are used in the child care centers cover about 20,000 children, lower income children, there are still approximately 5,000 children that remain on the wait list who are in that same area. And so the pre-K voucher program would directly provide an opportunity for those children to receive a high-quality early childhood education. Our second issue is the issue of income. And this year we focused on two areas. One is we have continued to support and help to refine the law on criminal record expungement that occurred last year. We made some changes to that bill this year and that policy to allow more lower-income folks to receive expungements by removing some of the barriers that lawyers were facing when they were filing those petitions, and also removing a provision that required everyone to pay a filing fee and said that those folks who were indigent would not be required to pay the filing fee. And that bill is on its way to the governor. We're excited about that. We also believe generally in the concept of the cliff effect in our income strategy, and that simply states that as individuals' incomes increase, we want them to be put in a position where they can take that income increase in the form of a higher paying job or a raise without losing benefits that are critical to them and may, in fact, cause them to refuse to take that increase because of what's called the cliff that they fall off of and can't afford to do that. In the area of health, we've been very actively involved in a statewide initiative called Jump In Indiana. And that is a large conglomeration of basically all the major players in healthcare in the state. And it's going to tackle the concept of childhood obesity. And particularly this year, you'll notice there was a great debate at the end of session about nutrition and daily activities and whether or not we should make sure that that stays in the child care regulation bill. In fact, we went to conference committee to make sure that those two issues stayed in when they were passed by the House but removed by the Senate. We were able to get a compromise and leave those in. And that's part of the childhood obesity initiative that's part of our health initiative. Finally, in the area of basic needs, we have actively worked with the Indy Chamber, who has been a great lead in that area, on mass transportation. We've taken we've staked out the area of making sure that the issues of senior citizens are considered when we talk about mass transportation, because if senior citizens can't get to the doctor or can't get to the grocery store, they really have less self-sufficiency, and what we want to do is provide opportunities for them to remain self-sufficient as long as possible so that they can remain in their homes. And then our final thing in the area of basic needs is the fact that we currently have a 2-1-1 system that is used throughout the state, and it's used for a variety of critical public services. In fact, though, it is not funded by government in any way. We would like to see that become a public-private partnership so that the philanthropic sector doesn't continue to have to provide all the funding to provide a service that is in many ways a public service. So those are the four areas, and that's how we focus our decision-making on what we choose in public policy.
We're talking about organizations with community focus, that how they choose what their priorities are in terms of advocacy. If you want to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Email's nolimits@wfyi.org. Twitter is WFYI, and Facebook is nolimits@wfyi. Andrew, I'm going to stay with you for a second, because the second part of that question really was, you know, the name United Way. I get if you're with the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, your focus is really on attempting to represent the interests and the needs of the business community. I also understand, you know, if the name of the Indianapolis Jewish Community Relations Council sort of captures the mission all by itself. United Way speaks to a different kind of mission, and also means to some degree that there are things you have to go through, because the presumption is that you're trying to represent everybody. So are there certain issues that, you know, what are the criteria, I guess, for deciding what is a common issue for what is a broad and almost to some degree limitless constituency?
Well, I appreciate that. And that is something that we discuss a lot, is trying to make sure that we know we can't be everything to everybody. Our main mission is to harness the collective compassion and resources of the community to change lives. And so I guess I would be remiss if I didn't mention that our campaign ends on the 31st, and we are at 93% of our fundraising goal of a $42.5 million.
Go ahead and give them a URL if you want to.
UWCI.org. We have had great support from the community this year, but it's not too late. March 31st is the deadline for this year. And we're often surprised that some people think you actually need to be part of a company campaign to participate, and that's not true. Everyone can participate. So we encourage you to consider doing that. To now address your question, John, mm-hmm. thank you for giving me the opportunity to say that. We do struggle with that issue because, you know, obviously we have 92 agencies that we provide some sort of support to, as well as our direct community impact work that we do as well. And so there are many, many interest groups involved. And so that's why I think what we're trying to do more and more at United Way is try to have broad-based community impacts by picking some items where we can really move the needle. And we try to make those decisions in our public policy work based on those ideas. For instance, early childhood education. We're spending a considerable amount of dollars mm-hmm. in that through our 10-year, $10 million plan for education improvement. And we realize, though, that through public policy, a simple change could amount to much, much more than that. For instance, today's voucher program will be spending $10 million. Mm-hmm. So, and that is going to final vote later today. So mm-hmm. certainly if we can get involved in things like that, that both align with our mission and also really move the needle, those are the types of things we look for. However, in the process, we consider every avenue of input that we possibly can. You can imagine that the agencies that we partner with to assist with funding often bring us issues forward, and we consider all of those. However, we have a very detailed system that we use internally. We have a subcommittee for public policy, which then reports to a full committee, which then reports to our executive committee, which then reports to our board of directors, which is over 90 community leaders throughout the city and the central Indiana region. And so to get on our public policy agenda.
That, to some degree, that sounds to me like you'd be deciding the cutting edge issues of the McKinley administration. You know, that it's such a cumbersome process. How quickly does that move?
It doesn't move terribly quickly. However, what I always say is if it makes it through that entire process, we really mean it.
Yeah.
And we're going to fight hard for those issues. And along the way, issues drop off.
Mark, I want to ask you real quickly, how does the chamber go about selecting its priorities? What is the process that you have to go through?
Yeah, we have a lot of things in place for that. We've been doing this for years and years. Mm-hmm. And first of all, we have a public policy resolutions document, which is sort of our constitution that we do of the issues that we are interested in and want to pursue, more global in nature in terms of the types of things we are basic philosophies for the chamber. And then every year we update and we either add to or delete from or reaffirm our public policy positions.
Who is involved in that discussion, though, in that process? How many players do you have at the table?
Well, quite a few. It's actually very similar to the process that was just laid out by United Way. What they do, we
have... So you guys are fighting the cutting-edge battles of the McKinley administration,
well,
too.
but it actually, it works pretty well. It's refreshed every year. We have public policy committees. They vet all the issues there. They reaffirm their issues. They add new ones. They take other ones, and then that goes to the executive committee, then the full board for their approval.
And David, in about 15-20 seconds, how cumbersome is the process for deciding priorities for you guys?
Just because we're a smaller organization, I'd say a little less cumbersome. I think it's about the same. We, around our board, we have a government affairs committee that recommends and then goes to the full board for discussion. Our board is actually made up of representatives from all the community agencies, organizations, and synagogues. And so those positions are then taken back by their representatives.
We are talking about how organizations set their public policy priorities. My guests are David Sklar, the Indianapolis Jewish Community Relations Council, Mark Lawrence of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, and Andrew Cullen of United Way of Central Indiana. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about how organizations, community organizations, set their public policy agendas, what issues they pick. My guests are David Sklar of the Indianapolis Jewish Community Relations Council, Mark Lawrence of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, and Andrew Cullen of the United Way of Central Indiana. We talked about what the process was for establishing what the issues are you're going to get involved in, basically who the players were at the table, who got to help make the decision. What priorities do you set? I mean, in terms, what criteria go into saying, okay, this is something we're going to get into? I mean, David, you were saying that social issues of social justice are there. Explain to me, for example, how mass transit fits into a social justice agenda.
Sure. So when we're working on our public policy issues, we're first and foremost as the basically the public voice of the Indianapolis Jewish community. We're always looking at whether an issue is sort of a Jewish issue. Mm-hmm. We're looking at whether an issue is important to the Jewish community. And we're also, looking at whether this particular issue can help build a stronger community and society around us. And so for us, this fills a lot of those criteria. Within our community, we have a number of agencies and organizations that have a lot of staff members that use the public transportation system. So obviously supporting them. We have an ever-increasingly aging population in the Jewish community, and we have agencies that serve that population. So obviously benefits seniors in our community to better access the community around them. And we really looked at it from a sort of an economic justice perspective that building a stronger mass transit system is going to help, people find and maintain jobs, increase their economic mobility.
Is there a rubric or a set of criteria that you use or that the JCRC uses in terms of making decisions
Sure.
about whether this is an issue for us or it isn't?
Absolutely. So the biggest thing, again, just to give a little bit of perspective on who we are, our board is made up of representatives from all of the agencies, synagogues, and community organizations in the community. They send their representatives to us. And what we are is basically the consensus building organization in the community. And this consensus is a word that we like to use a lot. So we have a system that allows each of these organizations and representatives to provide input into the policies. We don't necessarily have a strict definition for what consensus is. We sort of know it when we see it. But if we have consensus to work on an issue, we do. If it's clear that we don't have strong consensus to work on an issue, we don't.
Mark, you'd mentioned that there's kind of a constitution that the chamber operates by. What are some of the things in that constitution? I mean, I'm assuming that's really your rubric, your set of criteria that whatever you guys get into has to match up to that.
Well, actually, that does serve as sort of the basis, but the more relevant thing for day in, day out deciding what we do is the legislative business issues. But the kind of things that would be in our public policy resolutions would be general concepts towards the creation of jobs, free enterprise, tenants, and other things like that, that would be included in that. Really, it gets much more detailed in the legislative business issues when we have taken by areas. We cover education, we cover infrastructure, we cover health and wellness, civil justice, and other issues, local government reform. And we have different positions in there that we vet every year that we run by our policy committees, which can include members and also board members. And we have 150 board members really from all around the state representing pretty much the broad spectrum of Indiana business. But those kind of issues may get more specific on certain issues on how we stand on, for example, local government reform, you know, that we want to see things that came from the Kernan Shepherd report implemented and those kind of things to streamline local government. And then what we do is we do get into issues from time to time that come up that a bill's introduced in the State House. We may not have a clear position on that. And what we will do then, we go back, and that's what our executive committee does, is they serve as a sounding board for the full board of directors when it's going to be in between board meetings when they approve these resolutions.
We are talking about how organizations set their priorities in terms of public policy advocacy. If you want to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Shoot us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Twitter is WFYI, and Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Andrew, let's attack this from the other end of the angle. I mean, particularly with the United Way, since, to use David's word, there has to be a certain degree of consensus for, you know, the areas you're talking about are fairly broad, the four that you listed. What issues do you choose not to get into? I mean, how do you make a decision, no, that is not for us?
Well, fortunately, we have a committee process that is put in place to sort of make those decisions for us. We, you know, basically our vision at United Way is to make Central Indiana a community where individuals and families can thrive and neighbors can care for each other and we can be proud to call ourselves part of the community. And so that kind of leaves out some issues. You know, we don't necessarily get involved in some of the same issues, for instance, the chamber would get involved in, detailed taxing issues or issues that are of a very specific nature that aren't necessarily about the overall community.
So you
health.
Wouldn't get in on the business personal property?
No, I would find it very surprising if we would ever take a position on something like that.
And, you know, and Mark, in terms of same question, I mean, what issues would the chamber just never get involved in and think this is, you know, this is not really what we care about?
Well, there are certain issues that we get in, and let's just talk about an issue that I'm involved with, which is local government reform. We generally don't get into annexation issues or things that tend to be more specific community oriented. Although we don't, that's not always the case. For example, we did support the mass transit initiative. We weren't necessarily the lead on that, but we were part of the coalition that's been working on this issue. So if there are things that are in specific communities, we tend to take more of a statewide view of things that we think will positively impact, you know, the business community throughout the state.
David, same question. I mean, what are some of the issues you guys would just say, nope, that's a non-starter?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of sort of, you know, like Andrew said, there's a lot of detailed issues that we may not get involved with. But I would honestly say that, you know, we don't necessarily have any issue that isn't our issue until we have that discussion. You know, there's a lot of different ways that we could see ourselves getting involved in all of these issues. And, you know, our best process is our discussion process. And so I wouldn't say that there's anything that it would absolutely not be one of our issues until we'd sit down and have a discussion about, you know, whether it was a Jewish issue or whether it did affect the Jewish community.
Could you give me an example of a discussion where you decided, no, that's not for us? What the issue was.
I'll go back quite a ways. And this was actually a little bit before my time, but I've heard these stories. There was a one example that one of my community members likes to talk about. There was an issue quite a few years ago about whether the state would tax soft drink syrup, whether they would add an extra tax to that. And some people in our community, wanted us to get involved because the revenue from that tax would have funded social services and it would have helped the healthiness of our kids. But, we just felt that there were, there were some community members of our community that would have been sort of negatively affected by that tax. We didn't necessarily have all the information, and so that was something that we, again, to go back to that word, we didn't have consensus on working.
How do you communicate when somebody brings it? And I'm assuming this is the case for each of your organizations. Somebody brings something to you and says, you guys really ought to be involved in this. And you weigh it and you think, well, no, we really shouldn't. David, I'll stay with you on that. What do you say at that point, particularly if it is a member or someone who is part of your constituency?
Sure. I think we continue to tie it back to those issues, that I've talked about, that, we don't have the consensus within the community. If it's a matter where we think that other people working on that issue have more expertise, more background information or a better ability to do that, we'll say thanks but no thanks.
Mark, how about you?
Sometimes we get issues that come up that are important to the business community, but it might be more for a particular sector of an economy, and it might be more of an inter-industry fight. We generally don't try to get into those unless there's a larger, broader public policy implications.
Tax reform for radio talk show hosts or something
right, that
like
would be,
that, right?
Well,
yeah, that might be a little narrow.
Yeah. But no, we've had a number of issues on that, and I would say of all the bills that are introduced, and I think there are probably, 1,200 or 1,300 introduced this session, we review every one of those, and we run them through the filter to see how they stack up against our public policy.
Is filter metaphoric, or what? When you say you run them through the filter, what do you mean?
We read through them, and we see how they align with our public policy issues, that we positions we've already staked out on particular things. There are going to be certain things we don't get too involved with, some of the things with cosmetology or something like that. We just, we don't get it. It doesn't have a statewide purview. It doesn't have other things. And I guess that's sort of the filter.
When the beauticians were upset a couple of years ago, you were not that involved.
Yeah, although we did sort of have a general position that we think that, some of these things that are regulated maybe shouldn't be quite as much.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about how organizations with a community focus choose the issues that they're going to emphasize in the public policy arena. Please join the conversation by giving us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Andrew, same question. How do you, I would think, since everybody's going to be coming to the United Way as the 800-pound gorilla in the not-for-profit world, how do you say, I know we're supposed to work with everyone, but this really isn't our issue?
Well, it's occasionally issues are brought to us, and the first filter is, does this fit into our key priority areas, education, income stability, health, or basic needs? So if it doesn't, then most people understand that that's not where our focus is going to be. However, if it's an issue that fits into one of those, then we have a process, and that's why the process is in place. First step is, if it's a public policy issue, I would probably have a conversation with that person. Then we take it forward on the staff level to Jay Gachet, our senior vice president, Ann Mertlow, our CEO. And if we had sort of staff consensus that it should then maybe go forward, a lot of issues kind of stay there at the staff level because they're just not at all within alignment for our areas. But if we have questions, that's why we have the committee process. So then it goes to our public policy subcommittee. And we've had several issues that have gone to that committee and they've stopped right there. We had another couple issues that went to the next step. And then there's the next step. And so we really do believe in utilizing our committee process because our committees are populated with individuals from all walks of life, and volunteers are really the backbone of United Way. And so we really do let them make the final decisions on issues like this.
How heavily staffed are your organizations in regard to, attempting to shape public policy so that it aligns more closely with the needs and mission of your organization? Andrew, I'll start with you. How many people have you got working on shaping and driving public policy issues?
Well, we have an entire community services division. Within that division, I am the director of public policy, and I don't have any staff. So we don't
invest an incredible amount of money because we certainly have the ability to utilize our volunteers to help us. And that's one of the things that we really strive to do is ask our volunteers who are on our committees and who are community leaders and who are part of our campaigns to get involved in our public policy process. For instance, during the work we were doing on House Bill 1004, the vouchers, and also 1036, the child care, we had over 27 major Central Indiana CEOs sign on to that letter to the leadership in the Senate asking them to support those pieces of legislation. So I was able to take that information over to the State House and share that with senators. And that is, you know, incredibly valuable. So we have connections throughout our boards and volunteer groups that that we just utilize basically as, in some ways, our staff. For instance, Women United, which is a large affinity group of women who donate and spend a lot of time volunteering with United Way, have made early childhood education their top priority. And so they have been extremely helpful in this process. So that's the way we sort of get around that. So we also don't have to spend a significant amount of money on staff.
How large is your budget for public policy advocacy? We're dancing around the L word.
Well, I should.
I assume none of you would run away from the word lobbyist, but David's shaking his head. He's fine with it.
Well, I actually feel strongly that we shouldn't run away from that word because I've said several times since I've only been at United Way since June, and there were some pushbacks to using that word, and I said, well, first of all, we are registered lobbyists, and second of all, poor people deserve the same level of representation at the State House as rich people do. And, if I can help them get that through the use of United Way, I think that's what we ought to be doing.
Mark, how large is your public policy or lobbying team?
Well, it's actually kind of a multi-tiered answer. First of all, we have 7 full-time lobbyists who work on specific issues, and then our president is more of a generalist who kind of is a field marshal, if you will. Then we have an excellent communications team that help with our updates that we give to our members and also things that we want to do in terms of outreach to, the media. We use that quite a bit. They are a very talented group. And then we have a public affairs group with 3 or 4 people in there that they work on grassroots messaging. And also, like you had talked about, a letter that goes to the legislative leaders, but they work on things that would go to messages that we would send to our members and or have out on our website to say, look, we stand for this issue, and if you agree, please let your legislator know. Or, and so we try to really work with our members and our board members in terms of, forwarding our positions.
David, how many are you?
When you're talking public policy team, it's me doing our public policy. We're a very small agency. It's just myself and our executive director, Lindsay Mintz. So I'm the only individual representing the JCRC and the Jewish community at the State House. But we have a very strong and committed board of directors that really provides our staff with the support that we need. And we also have a government affairs committee of lay leadership from the Jewish community that provides us a lot of support, to help craft those position and when we need them to come to the halls with us to, increase our presence and talk with their legislators and reach out. And the Jewish community itself is very active and engaged on issues of public policy. So it's a lot of great support behind the two of us.
How do you mobilize all those folks? I mean, what's the...
Well, obviously, our board of directors is made up of representatives from our community organizations and agencies. So a lot of it is asking them to take the message back to their organizations and mobilize their organizations themselves. We're also slowly trying to finally get into the 21st century like everybody else and working on our social media and websites and, things like that to get the message out. So, but I think we rely a lot more on sort of that old style of communication, person-to-person communication to activate our community.
And how often do you, since it is only you, I understand these guys have much more elaborate structures within which they have to work. How often do you have to report back?
Again, since we're such a small agency, it's really an amazing relationship. And, between the staff, our director and myself are constantly in communication about things. And we also, have great communication with especially our executive a board and reporting back pretty regularly. And then during the session, you know, at least every other week or a couple of times a month, we will try to meet with our lay leadership, our government affairs committee, so that they can continue to help us have input in the process during the legislative session.
We're talking about how community organizations set their priorities in terms of advocacy. My guests are David Sklar, the Indianapolis Jewish Community Relations Council, Mark Lawrence, the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, Andrew Cullen of the United Way of Central Indiana. Please join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about how community organizations set their priorities in terms of advocating for public policy issues. My guests are David Sklar, the Indianapolis Jewish Community Relations Council, Mark Lawrence of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, and Andrew Cullen of United Way of Central Indiana. Well, I want to talk, you know, because you do have fairly, I don't want to use the word narrow, specific agenda items that you do. And some of these are fairly complex issues. They're not things that get boiled down to a soundbite real easily. How do you fight through the noise? You know, like we had an epic battle at the start of this legislative session over the whole House Joint Resolution 3 thing. Is it difficult in those circumstances, or to be fair, you know, one of the priorities for the chamber about 2 or 3 years ago, you know, the whole right to work battle that just overwhelmed every other question. How hard is it to fight through the noise on some of these more complex issues? Does it make it easier or make it harder, Andrew?
I think it definitely makes it more difficult when there's a contentious issue happening in the General Assembly. If nothing else, it just causes the place not to be as much fun to be around. And it really does cause folks to sort of fight amongst themselves and be angry with each other. And so fortunately, you know, we were able to work through that a little bit earlier a few weeks ago and sort of put that issue to bed. But it was a contentious issue, and I won't say that it didn't affect the rest of the work. And I also didn't particularly like being around during that sort of a debate.
How about you, David? I'm going to go with you because I'm going to reframe the question for Mark a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Especially, you know, we did work on that particular issue. So, you know, it was important to us. We were, you know, part of the coalition working against the resolution. So we were involved there. But, you know, a lot of the other issues that we work on sort of are some of those lower tier issues or smaller, more detailed issues. And so when something like that is going on and sort of, for a lack of better terms, is sucking up a lot of the oxygen, it is hard to make headway on some of those smaller issues that we're usually working on.
Well, that's a good image. And I guess, Mark, the way I'm going to reframe it is, not all that long ago, the chamber was one of those groups that was sucking up all the oxygen with the right to work and all of that. What's it like when you are pushing something that large that seems to be overwhelming, you know, all of the other discussions? Presumably that wasn't the only issue on the chamber's agenda that year. Do you have to kind of fight through the noise that you, to some degree, are in effect creating?
Well, yes, there are times, and I think that it was Andrew said earlier that, you know, sometimes it's a lot real crowded. It's not as much fun to be there. You hear the term sucking the oxygen out of the air. It does make it more difficult. At the same time, I mean, while these issues seems like they come and they have their time and they take up, you know, a focus of the legislature, every year there's one or two issues like that. Sometimes the noise level is higher than others, but there are other issues going on. There are policy committees and other areas happening. But it distracts from the conversations. I think in the case of the right to work, which was 2 years ago, and also with
three years ago, but really the
major discussion, and they got that done by early February. So there was a lot of the rest of that short session to do that. And the HJR 3 issue this year, once again, it was during the short session. So we're talking about during a short session, really, which is originally designed for more or less emergency issues, non-budget related, or, you know, so. but we've been able to, they're really just mini versions of the full session anymore that we look at it. But, you know, there are a lot of things that do get done at the legislature, and people do that. Certain things get a lot more media attention. I think that may be the case here.
Mm-hmm. David, you want to?
Yeah, I was just going to, you know, jump back in and say, you know, although it does, some of these issues do suck up, you know, some of the oxygen from our perspective too. You know, again, working on some of the smaller issues and often some of the more controversial issues, these larger issues aren't always a bad thing too, because sometimes they distract the legislature from some of those other issues that we'd rather not work on.
Allows you to fly under the radar screen,
right,
as it were.
Yeah.
We are talking about how community organizations set their priorities in terms of advocating on public policy questions. Devin, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. In relationship to or analogous to like corporations who have the lobbyists get legislation in progress for them, what type of, just because it's kind of new to me, what type of money has to be thrown at a specific issue to get these policies seen through to fruition? And does this, all this, these funds come from the community, from the business owners and from private individuals?
Good question. Thank you very much for the call, Devin. Well, Mark, I'll start with you on that one.
Sure. Well, I think in terms of money it takes to pass a particular issue, in many cases it's just our membership dues support our lobbyists. And so that's a sort of an ongoing fixed expense, and it's not issue by issue related. As it gets into some specific issues, for example, if the larger issue comes up, like on, let's just say, right to work, and we mm-hmm. feel there's a need for a media, we will get enhanced contributions or investments from people who are proponents of this to, you know, fund a public media campaign. But we don't do any outside expenses extraordinary for a particular issue as it relates to the lobbying. That's
yeah,
just part of our...
Well, after you basically after they've hired the lobbyists, your costs are marginal right. beyond that point. So.
But I will say, in many cases, we work very hard to get factual information prepared in advance uh-huh. of the issue. We try to make our issues based on fact as much as possible. And many times we have a foundation that works on coming up with facts, and we did an economic analysis of what Indiana would be like if it were to become a right-to-work state. Not everybody would agree with it, but what we have predicted is really becoming true in terms of job creation and mm-hmm. the average wage not going down. It's actually mm-hmm. going up, so we think it's important to do that. So we'll put outside money into it, research in advance of a topic.
How do you fund the lobbying piece of that? I mean, obviously, and I guess I'm inviting a discussion. This gets fairly inside baseball, but of the distinctions between a 501c3 and a 501c4. Andrew, I'll throw it your way.
Mm-hmm. Well, the distinctions, fortunately, are fairly clear. For instance, with United Way, there's a certain percentage of our overall budget that we can easily use for lobbying. Fully within the statutory and regulatory guidelines that are set federally for 501c3s, and we're nowhere near that in the amount of money we spend in lobbying. We also have the opportunity to sometimes receive specific gifts that are designated for the purposes of lobbying.
But those are generally not tax deductible.
Well, as long as it's a gift to United Way and it's the request that they use that we use those fundings for the purposes of lobbying for a not-for-profit, which is what we're doing, and we're within the guidelines of the rules and statutory regulations, it can be.
Okay. Well, David, how about you? Are you...
Yeah, we're the same way. We are also a 501c3, so, you know.
Do you have a 501c4?
We are strictly within the bounds of the IRS regulations as far as what percentage of our budget can be spent on advocacy and lobbying. And the JCRC is a constituent agency of the Jewish Federation here in Indianapolis, a Jewish Federation in Greater Indianapolis. So our budget basically comes from the Jewish Federation campaign. So basically the only thing that we're reporting to the state as far as lobbying expenses at the end of the year is the portion of my salary that has to get reported.
And Mark will ask the same question. Where do they fund the lobbying effort for the chamber?
Well, the chamber is a 501c6, different set of IRS regulations. We also have a 501c3, the foundation, and there, once again, the boundaries of what we can advocate on are mm-hmm. pretty well set, and we follow those very well. But our C6 means that status that if a member is investing, let's just say $100 in a chamber membership, that they can only deduct a part of that, mm-hmm. the portion that is not lobbying.
So, and how do you go about apportioning what part of the chamber's work is not lobbying?
Well, we all stay within the what the law says in terms of what is the portion that's there. So, and we have that all pretty much laid out by our, you know, executive committee and our just general management practices.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Mike. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. He says he'd like to ask a variation to a tangent on the rubric question. It says, and that question is, how can an organization like JCRC take a position on something like the mass transit bill when they know that they are never going to be responsible for any of the cost? As I understand it, this plan is to allow the counties to tack on local option income taxes that are only assessed to individual taxpayers, not corporate or not-for-profit, to pay upwards of 65% of the cost of any system built. So for JCRC or corporations to advocate for something they will never have an obligation to contribute to is concerning on an ethical basis from where I sit. It's a little like having dinner at the restaurant and then handing the bill to someone else on your way out. David, I'll throw that one your way.
I'm not sure that I necessarily see it that way. I mean, we're a very community oriented organization, a very sort of people-to-people organization. And, if those referendums were to pass here in Marion County and some of the donut counties, you know, that's a sort of an individual choice for individual taxpayers to take on some of that responsibility. I mean, obviously, if they were voting yes, they're voting to increase their income taxes a little bit to help pay for that system. So it's a choice. And I think that's really what that bill comes down to, you know, is allowing that discussion to continue, allowing those referendums to take place in Marion County and the outside counties. And, you know, so when we're an organization that you know, ask the agency representatives to come and have those discussions around our board, we're then asking them to go back and have those discussions with their organizations. So it's really a lot of individuals making those discussions. I mean, excuse me, making those decisions. And so they're having the discussions as well. And if they feel comfortable with the JCRC, taking a position like that or working on an issue like that, then we're comfortable knowing that we have the support of the Jewish community.
I'm going to ask Mark a similar kind of variation. I mean, how you deal with differences of opinion or differences of focus. I know, in the HJR3 fight that we talked about, the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce took a position on that. But the state chamber basically decided we're going to sit this one out. How did you arrive at that conclusion, particularly since there had to be some major players, people who are important, companies that are important members of the chamber who had taken positions on it?
Yeah. Well, there's certainly strong emotions and beliefs on that issue, both sides. Mm-hmm. And those were reflected in our discussions we've had at the board level and at the executive committee level. We've had several different discussions related just to this. And there was nothing that, at the end of the day, went through the process we have in place in terms of something being passed out of committee to say either oppose, neutral, or support on that. The executive committee did make the decision based on strong opinions that were represented there, because we have, for every one of the larger employers that, might have supported or opposed HJR 3 or 6 or whatever it was at the time, we also had many of our members around the state who had positions on the opposite side, and they, opposed that at all, so or supported that. So we have members on both sides, and we try to gauge and calculate that. At the end of the day, though, we do have a process, and it's a Robert's Rules of Order process that goes through the committee level and the executive committee level, and then the full board.
Is there any kind of calculation that says, it sounds like that was a fairly divisive argument within your own tent, mm-hmm. right there, yeah. And just said, we know this is a big issue. We know whichever way it goes, it's likely to have an impact on the business community. But there's really no way we can engage without tearing our own team apart. Is that I mean, how many of those kinds of conversations do you have?
Well, fortunately, they don't happen that much, that often. There was something several years ago, and it was literally a hand vote on the smoking issue because, you know, people have the
really strong feelings on that one, too.
Right, right. That was a similar thing. We had a board vote. We had to count hands on that to see what our position was going to be on that. So they don't come up that often. I think, generally speaking, there's a lot more agreement on the issues that we need to support or oppose on that. But, you know, from time to time, we do get some of the big ones that come in and take a lot of the media attention and then also have strong issues on both sides.
How long on something like that where you have that kind of discussion, and obviously somebody's going to walk away disappointed, you know, the folks who probably, well, in this case, I would think there's a good chance you disappointed both sides by saying, okay, we're not going to stake out a position against it. We're not going to stake out a position for it. We're just going to sort of sit and watch this thing unfold, which means neither side was really pleased. How long does it take them to get past that kind of?
Well, you know, I think that in the legislature, and I think back to the question that was emailed in, you know, it's really we are advising members of the legislature on what their decisions are. At the end of the day, it's a public decision that we have all elected these legislators to do. They're not going to do everything that we want them to do. And for anybody in this room, we're there to advise them. We're there to give them relevant information, let them know that our organization has a particular position on the issue. So I think that we really work very, very hard to try to, from our perspective, create a better Indiana through, you know, the policies that we want to promote and things that we oppose.
Andrew, you know, in terms of the issues, I mean, are there times you look at something and say, wow, you know, admittedly, these four categories we've got are fairly broad. But, man, I'd really like to get involved in that. I'd love to have the United Way, and we just can't do it. And if so, could you give me an example of an issue where you think, I wish we could have a voice there?
Yeah, you know, I really can't give you an example of that because our committee process sort of decides for me what I do. And so if I would, it would be me sort of speaking personally about things I would like for United Way to be involved in. And that's just not the way we do things at United Way, because we're a collaborative organization that's where decisions are made by a community-wide, in a community-wide way. We've had issues that have been brought forward. You know, getting involved in the healthcare debate was one. There were a few folks at United Way who thought we should be involved in the gay marriage amendment debate.
Was that a tough call to sit that one out?
Yeah, you know it. I get that question a lot. It wasn't a tough call to sit it out because I just didn't see how it fit into education, income, health, or basic needs at all in terms of United Way's priorities. It was tough for me to sit out of it because I thought it was absolutely ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And I didn't sit out on it because I'm friends with a lot of folks over there, but I didn't do anything officially in United Way's, name. But of course, you know, I think we can't be all things to all people. And I think it's really important that we remember that and that we stay focused. So because we are really trying to move the needle on a lot of community outputs. And if we start to wade way out of our of the deep end, into the deep end, we're going to be sorry and we're not going to be utilizing the dollars the way our donors expect us to do.
I'm assuming all of you are really, really happy the session's coming to an end. I'll take that as a yes. I'd like to thank my guest, David Sklar, the Indianapolis Jewish Community Relations Council, Mark Lawrence of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, and Andrew Cullen of United Way of Central Indiana. You've been listening to No Limits. I'm John Kroll. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Allseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.